This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Egg and Other Stories. Written by Andy Weir. Performed by Jonathan Davis, Christy Romano, and R.C. Bray.
Access. Holding a cup of coffee in one hand and several folders in the other, he dragged his chair out from behind his desk and plopped down into it. Sipping the all-important morning brew, he opened the first of the folders and read the summary on the front page. It was a minor matter, but something he'd need to deal with eventually. Some things just couldn't be delegated to subordinates. Glancing over at the ornate clock on his large oaken desk, he shook his head at the time. 7 a.m. A later start than he would have liked. He'd probably have to work until midnight. Again.
Oh, hey, she said sleepily. You're here.
He looked up.
Hmm?
She lay on one of the two fine couches that adorned his office. Stretching, she yawned and rubbed her eyes.
Damn, what time is it?
7, he said, returning to his reading.
Oh, for Christ's sake,
she groused. If I knew you'd be in this damn early, I wouldn't have crashed here.
He shrugged. So go back to sleep.
Nah,
she said.
I need to talk to you. Can I have some of your coffee?
He sighed. Look, whoever you are.
Rachel,
she said. Hi, Rachel. I'm very busy. I've only got an hour to finish this stuff before a bunch of meetings that last the rest of the day. It was a godlike feat just to get my own secretary to leave me alone for this hour. Now what do you want?
Well, that's kind of complicated,
she said, sitting in a chair across the desk from him.
I think we can help each other.
Oh, really? What's a teenager going to do for me?
I'm 23.
Good for you.
She leaned back, putting her feet up on his desk.
Thing is, I have a superpower.
This desk is an antique, you know, he said.
Oh, I know what you're thinking. I'm just some crazy girl off the street. But I really do have a power. Or something. Don't know what you'd call it.
Seriously, it's like 200 years old. Get your feet off it.
I first noticed it back when I was a kid,
she continued, putting her hands behind her neck. He groaned and put his file down.
My parents were drunks, both of them. They didn't beat me or anything, but they were drunks. Lowlifes, you know? Anyway, Mom liked hard liquor at home. Dad was more of a social drunk, so he'd head down to the bar. Everyone liked him. He'd bring me along. He knew Mom would be passed out soon, and he figured a bar was safer for a 10-year-old girl than an apartment with no supervision. It was cool. I was kind of a mascot there. One time, the bar got raided by the cops for letting the local high school punks in without checking IDs. I was there at the time. Nobody cared about me being there. But they wrote up the bar for all the teenagers. Technically, the cops should have written them up for me, too. That should have been a clue. But I was too young to pick up on it.
Pick up on what? He interrupted.
You'll see, she said.
He rolled his eyes.
When I was 12, Mom sent me to 7-Eleven to get her a bottle of dinner. I knew they wouldn't sell me liquor, but she gave me candy money, too. So, who was I to argue? When I got there, the place was being robbed. We lived in a pretty crappy neighborhood. It wasn't that uncommon. A guy in a mask had the owner down on the floor, holding a shotgun to his head. The robber looked at me, then went back to threatening the shopkeeper. I said, hey, mind if I take some booze? He just said, whatever. So I did. And some candy, too. Then I left.
Huh, he said. You're lucky he didn't shoot you or take you hostage. Still not seeing a superpower.
Hush, she said. When I was 14... I was in the best clique. No angst-filled high school years for me. I ended up friends with the most popular girls in school and dated the popular boys. It was awesome. Kids all over that school would have given anything to be in that group. You know what I did to get in? I sat at their table. Just, you know, at lunchtime. I sat at their table, and nobody told me not to. Eventually, they started talking to me and got to like me. That sort of thing. Anyone else who got within a mile of the table got extreme bitch treatment if they were a girl, or massive wedgies if they were a boy.
So, he said, folding his arms, your superpower is to be popular?
Don't be an ass, she said. Anyway, in high school, I wasn't the Virgin Mary, you know. Around 16, I started having my share of fun with the popular boys. Nothing outrageous. But a string of boyfriends during my junior and senior years. One time, I was with my boyfriend when his mom came home, unexpectedly. I should point out she was a hardcore Christian who thought her boy was a perfect angel. We were busy when she got home, so we didn't notice till she opened the bedroom door. All we had time to do was throw a blanket over ourselves. There we were, both of us in his bed, staring back at her. Know what she did? She told us she'd gotten Chinese takeout and headed back downstairs. Weirdest experience of my life, up to that point.
She probably didn't know how to react, he speculated. I bet her son caught hell for it later.
Nope. She never minded me being there. I could come over anytime I wanted. Till I dumped him. He was a loser, trust me. I barely graduated from high school. No college would take me, and it wasn't like I could pay for it anyway. Mom and Dad figured I was ready to join the real world and stop being a drain on them. So I got a job waitressing. Then I lost it because I was an unreliable smartass who never showed up for work. That was the beginning of my homelessness career. It wasn't too bad. I would do short-term jobs from time to time, and I lived in a tent. Anyway, one day it was raining buckets and the wind was like 40 miles an hour. The tent rode off into the sunset. So now I was in a downpour and had no tent. I decided I was going to get out of the damn rain no matter what. I'd break into the first house I saw and surrender to whoever was in it. I'd be out of the rain right away. Then the cops would come take me to a nice dry cell. So that's what I did. I wasn't quiet or subtle. I bashed in the window with a garbage can, scraped the shards out of the way with the lid, then climbed in. I stumbled through the dark living room onto a couch and waited. About 10 seconds later, the lights came on. A terrified-looking man with a baseball bat stared at me from the doorway, his wife peeking out from behind him. Once they saw me, they both let out a heavy sigh of relief and went back to bed.
Wait, he said. What?
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
Right.
She nodded. Did you know them from before or something?
Nope. First time we'd ever met. Can I continue?
Sure. Okay.
So anyway, I stayed at their house for weeks and they never complained. They even chatted with me. I can't say we became friends. In fact, I could tell they resented me being there. But they never kicked me out. That's when I started to realize something. I'd never been kicked out of anywhere, ever. I decided to put it to the test. Something small to start with. I went to a bank. There was a line. I walked right to the front of it. Nobody complained. I just cut in front of like 20 people. Everyone was fine with it. All right, on to phase two. They had a security door where the tellers could go in and out. I waited by it, then followed one of the tellers when they buzzed her in. Nobody cared. I even said hi to everyone and introduced myself. So I grabbed a handful of money from one of the drawers. Hey, what the hell are you doing? Someone said. Oh, my bad, I said, putting the money back. I'm new. Then everyone was happy again.
Seriously? He asked.
Yeah, seriously.
'Cause it sounds like bullshit. He said suspiciously.
I did more tests over the next few days. As far as I can tell, everywhere I go, everyone thinks I'm supposed to be there.
Yep, he said. Definitely smelling the bullshit now.
But it's not a free ride. People think I'm supposed to be there. But I can only get away with doing things they expect. I stole some drugs from a pharmacy, just to see if I could. I walked right behind the counter, got an empty pill container, and filled it with Valium. The pharmacists didn't give me a second look. People who are supposed to be there are expected to fill pill bottles. But people at a bank are not expected to grab handfuls of cash. See?
See? No. Smell? Yes.
I figure I can work for you.
See what I did there? He pointed out. I was talking about smelling the bullshit.
I need money. Give me a job with a good salary. I'll spy for you.
On who?
Whoever you want. I'm sure you've got all kinds of people you'd like to spy on. I could just go wherever they are and sit quietly. Maybe take notes. Whatever you want.
He sighed. If your delusion really were true, then yes, I could use someone like you. He agreed. But come on. You expect me to believe you can waltz into high-security areas past countless guards? And that you can chat with people there and they won't know anything's wrong? Can you provide any proof? Anything at all? She leaned forward.
I don't know, Mr. President. You tell me.
Antihypoxiant. I am, simply put, the most brilliant medical mind in human history. I know it sounds arrogant for me to say so, but there's a point where modesty has to give way to universally accepted facts. I invented the world's first and only universal antihypoxiant. If you're reading this, it's likely that you're a layman, unable to grasp what an antihypoxiant is. Simply put, it's a chemical that protects your body's cells from the harmful effects of oxygen starvation. You may be thinking that's not needed very often. Drowning, perhaps? Lung diseases, maybe? Well, you're wrong, of course. But it can't be helped. You're not a doctor. Or if you are, you're not one of my caliber. Hypoxia is what kills people. Whatever the cause of death may be, the actual reason they die is because oxygen stops getting to their cells, most notably to their brain. If your heart stops, blood stops moving around your body. Then your cells die because they aren't getting oxygen. If you get shot and bleed to death, you don't have enough blood to transport oxygen around. Do you see? It's all about oxygen. It took me over 30 years, but I was finally able to design a way around the problem. The trick is to have a redundant source of oxygen in your body. I formulated a molecule that can hold large numbers of oxygen atoms. It's similar in purpose to hemoglobin, though my design is better than anything God was able to churn out. The antihypoxiant, I won't bother to give you the chemical designation, it will only confuse you, can hold up to 58 oxygen atoms per molecule. For reference, hemoglobin can only hold 4. Also, the antihypoxiant is harmless to the body, can exist inside the cells themselves without affecting them, and can be in much greater quantity per volume than hemoglobin. I'll never forget the first successful experiment. I had a disembodied rat hamstring suffused with the compound. Then, I just let it sit for 3 days. By rights, it should have been completely dead. But upon examining it, I found that the cells were still very much alive and healthy. I got the compound perfected in the first 15 years. The larger question was how to deliver it.
It's no use to have a medicine that has to be applied at the time oxygen transport stops. For starters, it won't be able to get around the body. And more importantly, if you have medical attention, you are less likely to need the antihypoxiant in the first place. No, it has to be something you already have. It's not a medicine. It's a vaccination. A vaccination against death itself. Whatever your problem is, so long as there wasn't physical damage to your brain, you won't die for several days. This will give doctors time to fix whatever's wrong instead of desperately trying to keep your organs working. You can literally get shot in the heart, and they will have enough time to perform a heart transplant to save your life. So the question remained, how can it be applied? The compound is effective, but I was unable to make a version that wouldn't get cleaned out of the blood by renal functions. That's no use. You'd have to get booster shots every day. No, the compound is most useful when it has actually entered the cells of the body. And for that, I modified a virus. Viruses work by penetrating the cell membrane and injecting their own RNA into the cell. From there, the cell's functions get supplanted to make copies of the virus. They are naturally malevolent, but they are also a powerful weapon in a medical researcher's arsenal. After another decade of research, I was able to modify a virus to manufacture and deliver the compound. The original virus was a harmless strain that usually causes mild vasculitis. It attacks the cells of arteries, veins, and capillaries. This was ideal because it allowed my modified version to deliver the antihypoxiant to those cells. The vascular system is, by definition, positioned where oxygen is needed. I tested on cats, dogs, and eventually monkeys. The system worked perfectly. There were no adverse effects, and the animals now had a short-term immunity from death. I stopped the monkey's heart several times, the longest for 2 full days. When revived, he was unharmed. This was the breakthrough I'd waited for my entire life. But the FDA was the next step. After animal trials comes human trials. First with a tiny control group, then with larger and larger groups, and so on. Getting a drug through the FDA can take 10 years, and that simply wouldn't do. I was 57 years old at that point. Waiting another 10 years would make me 67. Then it would take at least another 5 to 10 years before the Nobel Committee recognized my genius and awarded me the prize I so richly deserve. There was a chance I wouldn't live to reap my due fame. Also of lesser importance, but still relevant, millions of people's lives could be saved by my compound in that time. No, the FDA was an impediment. It was time to act. Remember, the manufacture and delivery is done by means of a virus. All I had to do was breed up the virus and direct its evolution toward being more contagious. That took a mere 5 years. I released the virus in several major population areas all over the world. And the results were ideal. People started surviving accidents they should have died in. They lived long enough for medical help to save them. Soon, the entire world had been modified. Millions upon millions of people owed their continued lives to me. Unfortunately, I built up an immunity to the delivery virus while I was working with it. Sadly, that means I don't get to benefit from my own invention, because the virus can't deliver it to my vascular system. It's a shame, because my brilliance should be maintained for humanity's sake. But, alas, I will have to take my chances with death. All went well for a couple of months, but then problems started to arise. It turns out that the higher cognition centers of the brain have a slightly different blood-brain barrier setup. My compound, while transitioning into those parts of the brain, changes slightly due to the barrier and ends up malfunctioning. Instead of storing oxygen The compound combines it with a protein present in cranial vascular tissue and renders it inert. So the nearby brain cells die from lack of oxygen as the antihypoxiant collects it all and ruins it. There's irony there. In any event, it caused people to slowly lose their higher cognition abilities. They retained motor control, sensory input, fight-or-flight reflex, etc., but they lost their ability to think. Admittedly, this is a flaw in the system, but I can't be held responsible for that. Cats, dogs, and monkeys don't have that part of the brain at all. How was I to know it would be a problem? Most people have now descended into simple creatures, operating off their lower animal functions. They roam around, seeking food. They're actually quite dangerous because they will try to eat you. Unfortunately, if you shoot them, they don't stop. My antihypoxiant ensures all their tissues continue to work even without blood flow. The only way to kill them is to shoot them in the head. Society is ruined. All forms of law and order are gone, and roving hordes of mindless people wander the streets. Some could argue this is my fault, but that's absurd. Clearly the FDA is at fault. If it weren't for their slow process, I wouldn't have been forced to distribute the compound like I did. In any event, there's a horde of zombies pounding on the door. Time to grab my shotguns and move on. I think they can track me by smell. I should do a study on it.
Annie's Day. I didn't want to wake up at 6 a.m., especially on a Saturday. But the man I was cuddled up to was a morning person. Paul got up god-awful early, as usual. I had to endure temporary wakefulness as he removed his arm from under my head. Then he ran his fingers lovingly through my hair while trying to convince me to wake up. Tip for all you guys out there. If a woman is asleep, let her sleep. If you're anything other than newlyweds, she does not want you groping her in the morning. He finally gave up and went off to do whatever the hell morning people do. I fell back asleep within minutes. I awoke at the more reasonable hour of 10 a.m. and trudged to the kitchen to get some breakfast. Paul was at the table with the electric can opener in 100 pieces. It had broken the day before and would only cost $10 to replace, but he'd rather spend hours fiddling with it than admit defeat. I indulge his idiosyncrasies to a point, but I also wanted us to have a functional can opener. He had one day to fix it or buy a new one. As Paul worked on the can opener, Billy watched TV in the living room. Billy was 16 years old. His mother, Paul's ex-wife, left a decade ago. In the 5 years since I moved in, I watched Billy grow from an annoying kid into a man who looks like his father. I've grown to like him. I really like him. A lot. In fact, I want to feel his hands all over my body, and... Anyway, Paul and Billy went off to watch a baseball game, so I had the day to myself. I started with a leisurely bath. Then I took advantage of the beautiful weather and sunbathed in our backyard. It was nice while it lasted, but the wind started to pick up, so I gave up on it. I dropped in on Mrs. Marlowe down the street. She's 84 years old and always happy for the company. I spent a few hours with her, and she told me about the wild stuff she used to do when she was young. She'd told me the stories before, but she was a nice old lady, and I didn't have anything better to do. On my way home, I passed by Dwayne and Sally's house. Sally's hated me ever since she caught me sitting in Dwayne's lap at the 4th of July barbecue. In my defense, there weren't enough chairs. Maybe his hands wandered a bit, and I didn't discourage him, but it was his fault as much as mine. She glared at me through the living room window as I passed by. I ignored her. And just to piss the bitch off, I cut across her lawn while turning the corner. She glared harder, but didn't do anything. Our next-door neighbor Maureen and her toddler Ryan were in the front yard. Maureen texted on her phone instead of paying attention while Ryan toddled around aimlessly. Once he saw me, he meandered in my direction and extended his arms for a hug. I slapped him across the face. I hate children. I casually went into my house, leaving the crying Ryan and clueless Maureen behind. Passing the kitchen table, I saw the various pieces of can opener laid out, neatly organized. I took one of the smaller pieces and hid it under the refrigerator. Then I spotted Billy's laptop. He rarely left it unguarded, usually keeping it hidden in his room to protect it from prying eyes. But in the rush to leave for the ballpark, he'd left it charging on the coffee table. So I spent the rest of the afternoon on his computer. The boys got home in the early evening. Paul worked on the can opener for a while, before giving up in frustration. Billy didn't notice I'd been on his laptop. How could he? I left it exactly as I'd found it. Paul went to bed at 10 p.m., like always. I rarely went to bed when he did. I usually joined him hours later. But tonight would be different. Tonight, I had a plan. I just couldn't hold back my feelings any longer. Billy played video games in his room until midnight. I waited patiently until he shut the lights off. I summoned my courage in the hallway and finally did what I'd been wanting to do for months. Pushing his door ajar, I slipped into his bedroom. He lay under the covers, not quite asleep. He hadn't noticed me come in. I was deliberately quiet and it was too dark to see. Sneaking to the side of the bed, I got in and under the covers. He sure noticed that. Startled, he wasn't sure what to do. I didn't give him time to think. I pressed my naked body against his bare chest. We'd never done anything remotely like this before. Now it was time to see if my gamble paid off. What would he do? He caressed my body, slowly at first, and then with more vigor, as I writhed joyfully. I loved everything he did to me, and I let him know it. After a while, we fell asleep together. "Hey, bud," Paul said, leaning into Billy's doorway. "I made breakfast." "Okay," Billy said, waking up. "I'll be right out." "Huh," Paul said, taking in the scene. "Annie slept with you last night?" "Yeah," Billy said, looking over at the cat. "First time she's ever wanted me to pet her."
The real deal.
"I tell you, it's the real deal," Ray said. "The real deal."
"Oh, yeah?" Bobby replied. "Tell me more."
"She's the most amazing woman I've ever met."
He snatched his cigarettes from the coffee table.
"I mean, we've only had one date, but wow. I never met a chick I could really talk to before, you know?"
"Cool," Bobby said.
"Her name's Liz," Ray said, lighting a smoke.
He offered the pack to Bobby, who shook his head.
"I mean, don't get me wrong, I still want to bang her, but I don't just want to bang her, you know?"
"Yeah, I get the general idea."
"We met last week at the Kennedy rally."
He stopped.
"You're voting for Kennedy, right?"
"Of course."
"All right, then. Anyway, she's a volunteer for the local Democratic Party. Hands out flyers, knocks on doors, that sort of thing. But she's not like the other chicks there."
He took a quick drag from his cigarette.
"She actually understands the issues, see? She's not some ditzy half-wit who's only there 'cause she thinks Kennedy's cute. And she's not a campus radical or anything. She can back up her political views with reasoned argument. Do you have any idea how rare that is?"
"You don't see that every day," Bobby agreed. Ray smiled.
"I asked her out, just like that. I'm a chicken, I never do that. But somehow I just had to, you know? And she said yes."
"Where'd you take her?"
"Well, I don't have a lot of money. And the election's soon, so we're too busy to take a long lunch. I took her to Sambo's on the corner. We had a great time. We talked, we laughed, we discussed politics, I tell you.
I could have stayed right there and had lunch with her forever.
Sounds like you're really smitten with her.
Smitten nothing. I'm in love. This is the woman I'm going to marry.
That's pretty fast, Bobby said. You met her a week ago and you've only had one date.
One date's all it took, Ray shrugged. I can't wait till the election's over. We'll have time to go on a proper date. A day-long outing. I got it all planned out. And if Kennedy wins, she'll be in a really good mood. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I follow.
You know what's the most amazing part of her? Her eyes.
Oh, yeah?
It's like there's this incredible intellect hiding behind these gentle, beautiful eyes. Just lurking there, waiting to be seen. And I see it, man. Believe me, I see it.
You should tell her that.
Oh, I will. Don't you worry.
He took a long puff from the cigarette and stood.
I gotta use the can.
Bobby gestured down the hallway.
I figure I'll start the date with lunch, Ray said from the hall. Maybe move on to a matinee. Think that's a good opener?
You're not going to talk to me while you're actually peeing, right? Bobby called back.
I think it's a good opener, Ray continued. If the weather's nice, we could take a walk in the park. It's all about maximizing conversation time with her. She's really neat to talk to, you know?
I'm sure she is, Bobby said. Really, though, just do your business, then continue the story when you get back. After a few moments of silence, Ray called back.
Hey, man. There's some old guy in your bathroom.
Bobby scrambled to his feet and darted down the hall.
Who are you?
Ray asked the old man.
Can we help you with something?
Bobby grabbed Ray's arm and said, Come on. This way.
There's an old man in your bathroom, Ray said, gesturing to the man. Aren't you curious what he's doing here?
Come away from the mirror, Dad, Bobby said, pulling him out of the bathroom.
What? Why don't you tell me more about Mom? What?
Who?
Liz, Bobby said. Tell me about Liz.
Ray stood motionless, his face falling blank. Then he smiled.
I tell you, it's the real deal, he said. The real deal.
Oh, yeah? Bobby said. Tell me more. Bored world. He lay prone, his eyes fluttering open. Near darkness granted the sky a dark blue hue. Was it early morning? Late evening? He didn't know. Gentle winds rustled the tall grass surrounding him. Slowly sitting up, he took in his surroundings. There was nothing. Just tall grass, all the way to the dark horizon. His face grew increasingly more puzzled as he tried to remember how he got there. Last he remembered, he was in his apartment. Had he gone to bed? How did he get to this place? Standing, he brushed the dirt off his overcoat and turned a full circle, surveying the landscape. He looked for anything. Anything at all. Any feature, no matter how minor, might tell him where he was or how to get home. There was nothing. Boredom. He cringed at the sudden sound. No, it wasn't a sound. It was a thought, but not his own. Who's there? He called out nervously. Me. Jerking his head about, he tried to find the source of the words. But they hadn't come from anywhere. They had simply happened. Where am I? He asked. Me. That's not an answer, he said. Where am I? Me. Who are you? Me. He paced through the grass. There didn't seem to be any place to go, so he walked in a circle. I don't know why I'm asking you anything. I have no way of knowing if you're lying. What? Lying? You don't know what a lie is? No. It's when you say something that isn't true,
unable.
You can't lie? Everyone can lie.
Demonstrate. Lie.
Okay. I'm 10 feet tall.
Interesting.
A small table appeared before him. On it rested a plate with a roast beef sandwich.
What? He stammered. What the hell is this?
Reward.
You gave me a sandwich?
Humans require food.
You can make stuff?
Anything.
He picked up the sandwich. No point in worrying about poison. This entity could kill him easily if it wanted to. He took a bite. Not bad.
How did I get here? He asked between mouthfuls.
Took you.
Why?
Boredom.
You kidnapped me because you had nothing better to do?
Boredom. Millions of years. Sensed your plane. Interesting. Took you.
What are you?
Me.
Yes, I know you're you, but what are you?
Me.
Okay. One more try. What kind of being or entity are you? And don't say me. Give me an explanation of what you are without using pronouns.
Plane of existence. Alive. Self-aware. Wandering the void.
He gestured to the featureless terrain.
So this is you? You're this entire plane of existence?
Yes.
And you can reach into my plane. That's how you grabbed me.
Yes.
Then you can put me back.
Yes.
So put me back.
No. Must alleviate boredom.
All I'm going to do is try to escape.
That will be interesting.
Damn it. He crossed his arms and furrowed his brow. Okay, so you're bored. You want something to do.
Yes.
Look at Earth. The plane you took me from. There are billions of people there doing all sorts of stuff.
Daily lives. Boring.
So find something interesting.
Already did. Found you.
I'm not your damn pet.
Inaccurate. I will give food, care for, keep safe. You will entertain. This is a pet.
He thought for a moment.
If you send me to Earth, can you pull me back whenever you want?
Yes.
And it's impossible for me to get away, right?
Correct.
So send me home. I'll find you something interesting to look at.
A white door appeared in front of him. It was attached to nothing, simply standing upright in the meadow.
I think I see how this works, he said, opening the door.
As he suspected, it was a portal back to Earth. It looked to be a city street. Stepping through, he felt the hard sidewalk under his feet. Passers-by took no notice of his sudden appearance.
Excuse me, he said to a man walking by.
Yes,
said the man.
Sorry, never mind.
The man scowled at him and continued on his way.
They can see and hear me,
he mumbled. But they didn't notice me show up.
Protection.
You made them ignore me?
Yes. Only notice if you directly interact.
At least I don't look like a lunatic talking to myself.
Let's find you something interesting.
How about a museum?
No. Make abnormality.
Abnormality? Like what?
Make things happen that have never happened.
How would I do that?
You decide. I enact.
What can you do?
Anything.
So why do you need me?
You decide. I enact.
He narrowed his eyes.
You don't have an imagination. That's what this is about. You aren't capable of coming up with interesting things to do.
Correct.
So I'm not just a pet. I'm a service animal. Like a guide dog for the blind. I'm an idea human for the unimaginative.
Correct.
Fine. Give me powers like Superman or some other comic book character. I'll do all sorts of interesting stuff.
No. You are a part. You imagine. You explain.
He peered across the street and spotted a wealthy couple walking together. The husband sported a fine suit, while the wife wore the latest fashion and ostentatious jewelry.
Give that guy the ability to read minds.
Done.
The man stopped walking and blinked several times. His wife, having taken a few additional steps, turned back to look at him.
Darling, she said, puzzled. Are you all right?
You don't love me anymore,
the man said.
What? She said. Don't be silly.
You hate me. With every fiber of your being.
Sweetheart, what's making you...
You're planning to kill me. You're going to put sleeping pills in my evening drink and then set the house on fire. All right, I admit it. She snapped. You're a horrible husband. All I am to you is a fancy accessory. Something to show off to the men at your country club. You don't care what I think, what I feel, or what I want.
So you were going to kill me.
Why not just divorce me? I wanted the inheritance.
I had no idea you were so evil under that beautiful facade, so scheming, so manipulative, so devoid of morality.
That's your fault for never looking past my body.
Truth be told, he said, I'm a mob lawyer. I know some people who can make use of a gal like you.
Wait, what?
I never saw past your beauty because you never showed me there was anything there. Now I know, and baby, I like what I see. He grabbed her by the shoulders and pulled her in for a passionate kiss. She struggled at first, but then melted willingly into his embrace.
Oh, darling, that's all I've ever wanted. She said, can you ever trust me again?
I know you're telling the truth, baby, he said. Now come on. There are some business associates I'd like you to meet. They walked off together arm in arm.
Interesting.
The white door appeared before him on the sidewalk. Taking that as his cue, he opened it and stepped through back to the other place. It was unchanged. Didn't see that coming, he said, closing the door behind him.
Choose reward.
Huh?
Choose reward.
Okay, how about a big house to live in? Instantly, a stately manor house appeared. Reminiscent of an opulent English country estate, its wings stretched across the meadow, and its finely manicured gardens were a delight to behold.
That's beautiful.
He said, all right, if we're going to do this, I have some conditions.
State conditions.
For starters, I want a week of vacation every month. You drop me off back home and leave me alone. Set it up so I can interact with people normally.
Agreed.
If I ever get hurt or sick, you fix me up.
Agreed.
Never mess with my mind or use your mojo on me without my permission.
Agreed.
All right. Then we have a deal. By the way, what's your name?
No name.
You don't have a name?
No society. No peers. Alone. No need for a name.
Well, you're not alone anymore. And I need to call you something.
Name me.
Sure, I can give you a name. Let me think for a minute.
He cast his gaze upward at the sky that was neither day or night.
I'll call you the Twilight Zone. Nice to meet you. My name's Rod.
The Midtown Butcher. Michelle fanned herself in the sweltering evening. As a college student living alone, she couldn't afford a place with central air, and her dingy apartment's wall-mounted air conditioner was a joke. The best she could accomplish was to open all the windows and hope for a breeze. Her favorite sitcom had finished, and the local news had come on.
Police are continuing their search for the Midtown Butcher, the announcer said with an appropriately sad face. He's killed 6 women so far, all in their early 20s, all in home invasions. Investigators believe he first gains control of his victims at gunpoint and then...
She turned the TV off. Nothing interesting to watch. With a sigh, she pulled herself off the couch and trudged to the bathroom. She turned on the shower and doffed her clothes. After the water warmed to a reasonable temperature, she adjusted it to be a little colder than usual. She stepped in and let the refreshing water wash over her. It coruscated down her body in rivulets of relief from the sticky heat she had endured all day. Duchess, as she always did, loped into the bathroom and hopped onto the toilet seat. She watched Michelle through the glass shower doors and meowed in mild indignation. "Yes, I know," Michelle said apologetically. Duchess meowed again. Yes, I'm a bad person for showering instead of petting you. Having lodged her complaints, Duchess flopped down on the seat and waited for the shower to be over. Michelle grabbed the soap and began cleaning herself. She washed her face, then her shoulders, arms, and chest. She had just started in on her legs when Duchess suddenly stood and spun to face the doorway. Usually a mellow cat, Duchess cringed as she stared intently into the living room. She slinked off the toilet and hid behind it, never taking her eyes off whatever had her attention. Michelle craned her neck, but didn't have the angle to see what the cat was looking at. Michelle immediately remembered the news report she had heard only moments earlier. The police were still looking for the Midtown Butcher. No, it couldn't be, she thought. It couldn't be. Duchess cringed further behind the toilet. Someone's in the apartment, Michelle concluded. Shit. She realized she had been frozen in place for several seconds. If he knows I'm on to him, he'll have no reason to keep sneaking. I need time to think. She moved around a bit to make the water splash differently, as anyone taking a shower would sound like. Could it be a friend visiting? She thought. No. None of my friends would walk in without knocking. Besides, the front door is locked. The only way in is to climb in through a window. Stupid, Michelle. Stupid, stupid, stupid. You left all the windows open. Maybe it's just a burglar, she thought. He can take my TV, computer, whatever. Then he'll leave. I'll just pretend to not notice and I'll be fine, right? She considered it for a moment, then shook her head. No. A burglar wouldn't break into a place with people in it. With all the windows open, anyone could hear the shower running from outside. The only reason to break in is to get me, not my stuff. Her heart pounded as she shook with adrenaline. He's coming for me. She tried to keep from hyperventilating. I have a gun, but it's in my car, damn it! She darted her gaze around the shower. I need a weapon. Shampoo? No. Soap? No. Loofah? No. There are knives in the kitchen, but that may as well be a million miles away. She looked through the droplet-speckled glass door to the bathroom sink. Blunt objects? Hairbrush, maybe? Oh, I've got it. The curling iron under the sink. Good handle and a solid metal shaft. I could do some damage with that. A shadow flitted across the doorway. A surge of terror gripped her so hard she could barely breathe. He's coming. Now. I don't have time to get to the curling iron. He'll have a gun, and it'll be pointed at me. He could kill me with the twitch of a finger. Her mind raced. I'm naked and unarmed in a shower.
I'm small and I'm a woman. He won't expect me to fight back. He'll expect me to give up and let him do what he wants. That'll buy me a few seconds. First thing he'll do is tie me up or put me in handcuffs. I have to act before that, or it'll all be over. She looked down at her body. I'm wet and slippery. Maybe I can run past him and make a break for it. No, too risky. He might just shoot me. The gun came through the doorway first, followed by the arms of the man holding it. He used a two-handed grip while keeping his arms parallel to the ground. Michelle abandoned hope of it being a misunderstanding. He knows how to hold a gun, she thought, and how to walk with one drawn. He's moving very slowly to keep me from noticing. I have 3 seconds, maybe 4. She balled her fists. I'm not just going to let this happen. I'm going to fight with everything I've got. I may only have a few seconds before he kills me, but by God, I'll do some damage on my way out. Maybe he'll be surprised enough for me to escape. Either way, he definitely won't get what he came for. The man pivoted around the corner and pointed his gun at her chest. She had never seen him before in her life. He was young and physically fit. She might have considered him handsome under different circumstances. He looked nervous, even though he had every possible advantage. They locked eyes. The glass shower doors, she thought. I'll break the glass with my elbow and try to grab a shard. It'll cut my arm to ribbons, but it's better than fistfighting an armed man who outweighs me by 50 pounds. She summoned all her courage and cocked her arm back as the man approached the shower. Michelle Becker, said the police officer. You're under arrest for 6 counts of home invasion and homicide. You'll never take me alive, you cop bastard, she said. Then she shattered the glass with her elbow.
Meeting Sarah. Daniel Stoltz sat comfortably in the back of his limousine as it conveyed him through town. He held a phone to his ear, its spiral cord leading to the center console next to him. It was the pinnacle of modern fast-track life, a phone in the car. Enviable technology, and Daniel had taken to it instantly despite the exorbitant costs. Hello, Daniel Stoltz here. Mr. Stoltz, came the voice from the other end. This is Maria Town of the San Francisco Chronicle. Do you have a moment to chat? Sure, why not? I'm out on an errand right now, but we can talk for a minute if you like. Thank you for taking the time, said Maria. First question, what is the secret to your success? You have a large personal stake in companies such as Microsoft and Macintosh. Actually, Macintosh is the name of a product, he said. The manufacturer's name is Apple. All right, I'll note that down. Anyway, your investments have proven to be perfect. Everything you fund turns a huge profit. Some say you have the Midas touch. What do you say to that? I don't see how I could, he said. I don't do anything. I just let them get on with their business and don't interfere. How do you choose what companies to invest in? He switched the phone to his other ear. Oh, I'm just like any other investor. I look at business plans and come to an informed decision. Let's turn the clock back a bit, she said. In college, you were a theoretical physics major working on your PhD, but you quit grad school and invested your then modest savings into various high-risk ventures. Why the sudden change of lifestyle? Oh, you know how it is. I was 24 years old and I decided to change my life. Happens all the time. Several experts in the field say you had innovative ideas. Ideas that could have revealed genuine understanding about the nature of time itself. They even talk about time manipulation. Daniel sighed. I did one equation about the curvature of space and people got all worked up about time travel. I guess it makes for good press, but it's just theoretical masturbation. But you wrote some detailed papers on it, she pressed. In one paper you state it could be possible to rewind time, sending your current consciousness back to a younger version of yourself. I was smoking a lot of marijuana back then, he said. I never understood why people take that paper seriously. You patented your experimental equipment, then never allowed anyone to reproduce it under threat of lawsuit. It completely stymied any further research on that line. Why did you do that? I'm a businessman, he said. The lensing apparatus I invented could have real value in the marketplace. It was a step on the road to extremely accurate timekeeping. Of course I patented it. It might be worth millions someday. She shuffled some papers on her end, then continued. On a lighter note, let me ask this. If you could rewind time like that, would you? Well, he said, there would be some serious downsides. Like what? You'd have to remake all the relationships you had, at least the ones that are important to you. Let me ask you, are you married? Yes, I am. 14 wonderful years. When did you meet your husband? Well, we dated for 2 years before getting married, so I guess it would be 16 years ago. All right, Daniel said. Imagine you rewound time 20 years. Now you have to wait 4 years just to meet him again. And even when you do, you have to do everything just right. If you mess up, he might not be interested, or he might end up with some other woman. See the problem? I hadn't thought of that, she said. If you value your personal relationships, rewinding time would be risky. Sorry, I got a little sidetracked, she said. Back to the real interview questions. I hear rumors that you're helping fund a new company. System Co., something like that. It's called Cisco. Yes, I have great confidence in them, Daniel said. The limo pulled up to a dilapidated apartment complex and parked at the curb. The driver cocked his head toward Daniel and said, "We're here, sir." Daniel nodded and returned his attention to the phone. "I have to go. I've got an important meeting. Anything else?" "No, that's great. Thanks for taking the time to do this interview, Mr. Stoltz. I know how busy you are." "No problem. Thanks. Bye." He hung up. The driver exited the car and walked around to open Daniel's door. "Shall I accompany you, sir? This neighborhood doesn't look entirely safe."
"Won't be necessary, Charles," said Daniel.
"Very well, I will endeavor to keep people from stealing the tires."
"Good man," Daniel said.
Unkempt, overgrown grass intruded on the footpaths as Daniel walked casually through the maze of structures. Paint peeled from every building, but the spray paint graffiti was fresh enough. Bars had been installed on most of the windows. He made his way to one specific unit and knocked on the door. After a few seconds, it opened. The woman who answered it was beautiful. Raven hair fell across her perfect face as she pulled the door open a crack. She peered suspiciously through the opening at first, but once she saw Daniel's finely tailored clothes, she relaxed a little. Men in designer suits rarely robbed low-income apartments.
"Hi," she said.
Daniel clasped his hands behind his back.
"Hello, my name is Daniel Stoltz. We've never met, but I'm actually from this neighborhood. I used to live two buildings over."
"You used to live here?" she said. "You don't look like you're from around here."
"It was in another life," he said. "Things are different for me now."
"Yeah, I guess so," she said.
"What can I do for you?"
He smiled and said, "I understand your cat just had a litter of kittens." Back at the limo, Charles watched warily for any potential car thieves. He breathed a sigh of relief when he saw his employer returning from the complex. Then he raised an eyebrow when he saw Daniel was cradling a tiny kitten in his arms. Charles opened the door and bowed curtly.
"A new friend, Mr. Stoltz?"
"A very good friend," Daniel said. "Take us back to the mansion, please, Charles."
"With pleasure, sir," Charles said, closing the door.
Daniel made a platform with his hands and held the kitten up to his face. She rubbed a fuzzy cheek against his chin and purred loudly. He smiled and stroked her fur.
"Nice to see you again, Sarah. I've missed you."
The Chef. "Doris," the doctor said.
"Hmm?"
"Doris, do you know where you are?"
"Certainly.
Doris replied. I'm in a hospital. Good. Good. Do you remember what happened? Doris furrowed her brow. Not all of it, no. I think there was an explosion? Yes, that's right, the doctor confirmed. You were very lucky, Doris. Your father's entire kitchen was destroyed by the explosion. It's a miracle that you survived with only minor burns. I suppose it is, Doris smiled. Do you know who I am? Are you my doctor? Doris guessed. That's right, I'm Dr. Mitchell. A pleasure to meet you, doctor, Doris said politely. We've met a few times before, actually, the doctor said. You've been my patient for almost a week. Your memories are a bit jumbled. Oh, I see, Doris said. Well, that can't be good. You're in fine physical shape, Doris. Nothing to worry about. You're just a little confused. You had quite a shock to your system. Do you remember anything from after the explosion? No, not really. I remember sirens and men lifting me onto, well, I guess it must have been a gurney. Then it gets hazy. That's all right. It'll come back to you. How about immediately before the explosion? Doris said. Well, I remember being at my father's house. I hadn't seen him in some time and I'd gone over for a visit. I don't remember the details, but I remember he wanted me to cook for him. I'm a professional chef, you see. A chef? The doctor said. Yes, indeed. I've been excellent at cooking my whole life, ever since I was a little girl. I see. Go on. I never found Mr. Wright, Doris continued. And in this modern era, a woman doesn't need a man to be complete anyway. So I had to make do on my own, and cooking was the only thing I was good at. May I ask, when did you first start cooking? Well, Doris pondered, I guess it all started around the time my mother died. Once she was gone, my father insisted I start cooking for him. He said that he was earning the money to maintain the household, and I had to pull my weight. How old were you at the time? 11. 11, the doctor said. That's pretty young to be cooking. Doris shrugged. It was no different at 11 than it is at 35. I was a little smaller and things were harder to reach. But with experience, I got to be as good as any adult. How often did your father make you cook for him? Pretty much every evening. On weekends, he'd want lunch as well. Occasionally, he'd want breakfast, but usually not. Did you resent it? Doris looked back at the doctor. Funny you should mention it. Yes, I did resent it. I didn't like being forced into that role, and I didn't like his arrogant presumption that it was my job to do it. Yes, I resented it. What did you do about it? The doctor said. Well, I left home just as soon as I turned 18. I went out into the world to make my way. That was almost 20 years ago. Ironically, the thing I was running away from was the only saleable skill I had. So I became a chef. How did that work out? At first, not well, Doris admitted. I was working in terrible venues. People didn't care about professionalism or presentation. They just wanted a quick meal and to be on their way. I hated it, but I pressed on. Then I learned how to market myself. I found the right places to advertise and made the right contacts. I started moving up in the world of cooking. There is no shortcut, I can assure you. Becoming an expert at your profession, be it chef or doctor, requires a lot of hard work. In time, I earned a name for myself. I became a commodity. People would call me and offer me jobs instead of me asking them. I started charging more and more, and people were willing to pay. I would do private parties, large groups, even invite premier clients and their friends over for a custom meal in my own home. After all, the business they got for me was well worth giving up an evening for. And during this time, the doctor said, you never visited your father? No, Doris said. I guess I still resented him, she said. Irrational, I know, but there you have it. Emotions aren't always rational.
So how did you end up at your father's house the day of the explosion? Well, I decided it was time to drop by, Doris explained. I figured I couldn't hold a grudge forever. It had been 20 years. Maybe things didn't go well for us back in the old days, but I was an adult now. And I figured I at least owed him a visit or two. He did raise me, after all. And how'd that go? Well, like I said, the first thing he wanted was for me to cook him a meal. I'll be honest, it kind of made me angry. After 20 years, he hadn't changed. Not at all. Not one little bit. I was pretty disappointed. So what did you do? I went to the kitchen, Doris said. What else could I do? He followed me in there. We'd chatted for a bit while I got ready to cook him something. It was a gas stove, and I must have inadvertently turned on the gas while talking to my father, then forgotten that I did so. Then I turned on another burner and tried to light it. That's pretty much the last thing I remember. Dr. Mitchell leaned back in his chair. Doris, can I ask you a question that may seem completely out of the blue? Doris shrugged. Whatever you like, doctor. He took a deep breath, then let it out uneasily. Looking her in the eyes, he asked, What's the difference between a teaspoon and a tablespoon? What? Doris said, taken by surprise. A teaspoon and a tablespoon. What's the difference? A teaspoon is a spoon used to stir tea, Doris explained, while a tablespoon is used for other eating uses such as soups, custards, and desserts. Dr. Mitchell rubbed his brow. No, Doris. Teaspoon and tablespoon are both units of measurement used by chefs all over the world. Any professional chef would know that. Even ordinary people who cook at home know that. You're not a chef, Doris. You never have been. Doris snorted. Well, that's just ridiculous. Of course I am. I've been doing it my whole life. No, you haven't, Dr. Mitchell said. I have your criminal record. You've been arrested for prostitution 7 times over the last 20 years. Doris stammered, incredulous. That's utterly absurd. You've obviously mixed up my file with someone else's. What kind of hospital is this? It's a mental hospital, Doris. You killed your father in that explosion, and you were trying to kill yourself, too.
No!
Doris yelled, struggling at her restraints.
That's not true! I'm a chef!
You transposed sex with cooking. Ever since you were 11. It was a defensive mechanism. It was the only way you were able to survive.
No!
Doris screamed. But you were strong, Dr. Mitchell said. Stronger than he thought. Strong enough to run away. Strong enough to survive by selling yourself. And strong enough to come back and get revenge for what he'd done to you. Doris groaned. He's dead, Dr. Mitchell said. He can't ever hurt you again. He's dead and you killed him. You got revenge. You won. Doris howled a primal scream so loud Dr. Mitchell worried she would permanently damage her vocal cords. He quickly pulled out a needle and injected her. As she slipped into unconsciousness, he made a note in his case log. We'll get you through this, Dr. Mitchell said to her unconscious form. You survived things that would break normal people, and I'll get you through the rest of the way. I promise. He checked his notes. 2 days ago, she didn't remember the explosion at all. Yesterday, she remembered the explosion, but not that it was at her father's house. Tomorrow, she'd remember more. He was sure of it. I promise, he said again as he left her room and locked the door.
The Egg.
You were on your way home when you died. It was a car accident. Nothing particularly remarkable, but fatal nonetheless. You left behind a wife and 2 children. It was a painless death. The EMTs tried their best to save you, but to no avail. Your body was so utterly shattered you were better off, trust me. And that's when you met me.
What happened?
You asked. Where am I? You died, I said matter-of-factly. No point in mincing words.
There was a truck, and it was skidding.
Yep, I said.
I died?
Yep, but don't feel bad about it. Everyone dies, I said. You looked around. There was nothingness, just you and me.
What is this place? You asked. Is this the afterlife?
More or less, I said.
Are you God? You asked.
Yep, I replied. I'm God.
My kids?
My wife, you said. What about them?
Will they be all right?
That's what I like to see, I said. You just died, and your main concern is for your family. That's good stuff right there. You looked at me with fascination. To you, I didn't look like God. I just looked like some man, or possibly a woman. Some vague authority figure, maybe. More of a grammar school teacher than the Almighty. Don't worry, I said. They'll be fine. Your kids will remember you as perfect in every way. They didn't have time to grow contempt for you. Your wife will cry on the outside, but will be secretly relieved. To be fair, your marriage was falling apart. If it's any consolation, she'll feel very guilty for feeling relieved.
Oh, you said. So, what happens now? Do I go to heaven or hell or something?
Neither, I said. You'll be reincarnated.
Ah, you said.
So the Hindus were right. All religions are right in their own way, I said. Walk with me. You followed along as we strode through the void.
Where are we going?
Nowhere in particular, I said. It's just nice to walk while we talk.
So what's the point, then, you asked. When I get reborn, I'll just be a blank slate, right? A baby. So all my experiences and everything I did in this life won't matter.
Not so, I said. You have within you all the knowledge and experiences of all your past lives. You just don't remember them right now. I stopped walking and took you by the shoulders. Your soul is more magnificent, beautiful, and gigantic than you could possibly imagine. A human mind can only contain a tiny fraction of what you are. It's like sticking your finger in a glass of water to see if it's hot or cold. You put a tiny part of yourself into the vessel, and when you bring it back out, you've gained all the experiences it had. You've been in a human for the last 48 years, so you haven't stretched out yet and felt the rest of your immense consciousness. If we hung out here for long enough, you'd start remembering everything. But there's no point to doing that between each life.
How many times have I been reincarnated, then?
Oh, lots. Lots and lots. And into lots of different lives, I said. This time around, you'll be a Chinese peasant girl in 540 A.D.
Wait, what? You stammered. You're sending me back in time?
Well, I guess technically. Time, as you know it, only exists in your universe. Things are different where I come from.
Where you come from? You said.
Oh, sure, I explained. I come from somewhere. Somewhere else. And there are others like me. I know you'll want to know what it's like there, but honestly, you wouldn't understand.
Oh, you said, a little let down. But wait, if I get reincarnated to other places in time, I could have interacted with myself at some point.
Sure, happens all the time. And with both lives only aware of their own lifespan, you don't even know what's happening.
So what's the point of it all?
Seriously, I asked. Seriously? You're asking me for the meaning of life? Isn't that a little stereotypical?
Well, it's a reasonable question, you persisted.
I looked you in the eye. The meaning of life, the reason I made this whole universe, is for you to mature.
You mean mankind? You want us to mature?
No, just you. I made this whole universe for you. With each new life, you grow and mature and become a larger and greater intellect.
Just me? And what about everyone else?
There is no one else, I said. In this universe, there's just you and me. You stared blankly at me.
But all the people on Earth,
all you, different incarnations of you.
Wait, I'm everyone? Now you're getting it, I said, with a congratulatory slap on the back. I'm every human being who ever lived, or who will ever live, yes. I'm Abraham Lincoln. And to John Wilkes Booth, too, I added. I'm Hitler, you said, appalled. And you're the millions he killed. I'm Jesus. And you're everyone who followed him. You fell silent. Every time you victimized someone, I said, you were victimizing yourself. Every act of kindness you've done to yourself. Every happy and sad moment ever experienced by any human was or will be experienced by you. You thought for a long time. Why? You asked me. Why do all this? Because someday, you will become like me. Because that's what you are. You're one of my kind. You're my child. Whoa, you said, incredulous. You mean I'm a god? No, not yet. You're a fetus. You're still growing. Once you've lived every human life throughout all time, you will have grown enough to be born. So the whole universe, you said. It's just an egg, I answered. Now it's time for you to move on to your next life. And I sent you on your way.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Egg and Other Stories. Written by Andy Weir. Performed by Jonathan Davis, Christy Romano, and R.C. Bray. Executive producers, Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer, Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2017, Andy Weir. Production copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.